The following episode examines a case involving the disturbing murder and dismemberment of a 13-year-old child. There will also be mentions of sexual assault. While case facts are delivered in a clinical and restrained manner, some listeners may find these details disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. On a hot, late summer day in August of 2005, a family out boating on the Little Calumet River, just outside of Chicago, made the horrifying discovery of human remains. Not long after, police divers pulled the dismembered torso from the water. The arms, legs, and head had been severed, making identification a difficult task, but one detective already had an idea of who it might be. 13-year-old Alexandra Anaya was a sweet, kind, loving, and athletic teenager who disappeared 3 days earlier from just across the state line in Hammond, Indiana. DNA tests would later confirm the horrible truth, and while Alex's family struggled to accept the horrors of reality, investigators began their hunt for the monster who had perpetrated this particularly heinous and vicious crime. While many believed that this had to be the work of a brutal serial killer in a random act of violence, Alex's family felt they knew exactly who the killer was. Not a stranger, not someone who randomly preyed upon Alex, but instead, a man who had come into her life when she was still a toddler and slowly transformed into her worst nightmare. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 154, The Murder of Alexandra Anaya. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the truly horrifying and disturbing murder of Alexandra Anaya. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 13-year-old Alexandra Anaya was enjoying summer vacation. Soon, she'd return to school where she'd be moving into 8th grade and was looking forward to trying out for the basketball team. Tragically, she'd never make it to 8th grade, and instead would suffer at the hands of a cruel and unconscionable killer who abducted her in the middle of the night. This is Episode 154, The Murder of Alexandra Anaya. The west arm of the Little Calumet River flows out of Indiana, crossing into Illinois where it winds its way beneath the stretched shadows of interstates and bridges. Passing through the Riverdale area, its shoreline arches north like a serpent, before cutting sharply back to the west where it splits off. For the most part, it cuts through quiet rural suburbs flanked by the emerald beauty of wooded areas and forest preserves. It's an appealing place to escape the rush and din of city life, with Chicago just 20 miles to the north. It was a popular go-to for those looking to get out on the water for an afternoon, whether launching a boat from one of the many docks along the shore, or simply getting out to paddle in a canoe or kayak. A slow but steady current offers little challenge, and while the river flows smoothly for the most part, some twists and turns lead to shallow waters, where paddlers might find themselves running aground as the river bottom sits as little as 4 inches from the surface. On a sweltering Tuesday morning in the late summer of 2005, the river's call was answered by all types. Friends out looking for a little fun, individuals looking to clear their heads for a few hours, and families planning to spend time together on the water as summer vacation would end in a few weeks and school would be back in session. While most people had set off into the waters looking for and finding the calm caress of the natural beauty, they had no way of knowing what lingered beneath the surface. For several days, the river had harbored a dark and terrifying secret, and on this particular morning, a horrifying discovery would rise to shatter a family who would find only tragedy in their desperate search for hope. In a shallow stretch between three bridges, a small boat motored through the water, its wake undulating along the surface. As the water rippled outward, one passenger caught sight of something breaking the surface. The shape was familiar, but undefinable from a distance, and so the boat changed course, the passengers looking to investigate. As they drew closer, details began to come into sharper focus, though the more they saw, the less it made sense. The shape itself appeared soft, ashen, and then there were flashes, sunlight gleaming off metal. It didn't flow with the current, but instead seemed to bob in place. As the boat approached within a few feet, it took several seconds for recognition to come screaming into perception. There, wrapped in heavy chains and somehow anchored to the river bottom, was a body. But there were no arms, no legs, no head. Panicked and scared, the boat reversed course, and within minutes, the empty shores were lined with police as news choppers hovered overhead, broadcasting the grisly scene live and in color. 15 miles away, across the state line and in the city of Hammond, Indiana, Lieutenant Ron Johnson was watching. A 30-year veteran of the Hammond Police, Johnson felt his stomach tighten as the terrible specter of knowing washed over him. It's not something that can be understood, not something that can be described. How sometimes, in spite of what you can prove, there are some things which you just know. Whether it's the way the hair stands up on the back of your neck when you walk into an unfamiliar dark room, or how your skin cools and heart pounds when you see a creeping figure moving through the night. There are simply some feelings, some realizations, that defy all logic and refuse to be ignored. Lieutenant Johnson picked up his phone and placed a call to the Chicago police to tell them about the case of Alexandra Anaya, a missing 13-year-old he'd been assigned to investigate just days earlier. It was too soon to know anything for sure, but that wouldn't make Johnson's next call any easier. He would need to speak to Sandra, Alexandra's mother. And somehow, he'd have to find a way to tell the desperate and heartbroken woman that he would need her to submit a DNA sample, just in case. The test would take 3 weeks, but Johnson had a dark feeling that he already knew what the results were going to be. Alexandra Maria Anaya was born on Monday, February 10th, 1992, in Merrillville, Lake County, Indiana, to her mother, Sandra. From the moment she was born, Alexandra became the focal point of Sandra's life, the central figure in her universe. While details regarding Alexandra's father are slim, Sandra has stated previously that she became pregnant during a relationship, and by whatever measure, the father was not involved in his daughter's life, leaving Sandra to be the sole parent. Bright and loving from a young age, Alex, as she was called, showed a compassionate heart and a deep caring for those around her. Friends, family, and teachers referred to Alex as a kind and gentle soul who was bright and bubbly, the kind of young woman who drew people to her and had a great amount of love to offer. Alex was noted as always being mature for her age, dependable, and with a genuine sense of understanding and responsibility. She was the type of person who, if she said she was going to do something, she did it. And there was no length she wouldn't go to help someone feel better. For Sandra, there were always two key features that caught her eye. Alex's brilliant smile that showed off her dimples, and her hair, which she referred to as almost a mane, so thick and curly. Alex showed a love of sports early on, and quickly honed her skills, which she would continue to sharpen over the next few years. While Sandra was single for Alex's early years, in the mid-90s she began a relationship with a man named Rodolfo Heredia, and over the course of the next decade they would be on again, off again, on again, off again. In 1998, Sandra would give birth to twin daughters, with Heredia being the father, though this seemed to have done little to quell what Sandra has since described as a volatile and difficult relationship. In later court testimony, Sandra described Heredia as violent, intimidating, and threatening. She recounted several instances in which she alleged that he had not only behaved in a violent and aggressive manner, but how he had also threatened her and others. This obviously led to a tense home life and a difficult environment for Alex to grow up in, but she managed to find a light in the darkness in the form of her new baby sisters. Alex loved her sisters and spent a great deal of time with them. She was, in a way, like a second parent, with one of her sisters later telling Case Files Chicago, quote, "Alex was like our mom. She was always watching us, cooking us food, helping us with our homework," end quote. The love was mutual, with both younger sisters looking up to Alex. With Sandra being the sole breadwinner for the family, this meant Alex often took on the role of babysitter, and while other children her age might resent that necessity, she took it on happily. She wanted to be there for her sisters, to help them, have fun with them, and spend time with them. It was a tight-knit family that enjoyed spending time together, whether it was listening to music, playing games, or just curling up under the blankets and watching movies all night. Alex attended Clark Middle School, where she performed well in classes, earning the adulation of her teachers. She was intelligent, informed, spoke fluent Spanish, and showed a gift for academics. She also had a charisma that couldn't be defined, allowing her to form a large group of friends. According to former classmates, Alex was the one who was always smiling and giving out hugs to friends at the beginning of the day. Outside of the classroom, she continued to thrive in the athletic world, eventually joining cross country, as well as playing soccer and volleyball. Sandra noted that volleyball was her daughter's favorite and was also the sport that she excelled in the most. But while her athletic ability was clear, Alex's dreams for the future were more focused. She'd always been a lover of animals, having multiple pets throughout her life and being enveloped by nature shows. She dreamed of one day becoming a veterinarian so that she might be around animals all the time. Over the years, Sandra and Heredia's relationship continued to unravel. In 2003, she and the children moved into a small home on Pine Avenue, near the corner of Hoffman, and Heredia was not invited, even though their relationship continued to back and forth for the next 2 years. All of that, though, would change after a shocking and heartbreaking confession. In the spring of 2005, not long after Alex turned 13, Sandra left Heredia for the last time. While this had been a long time coming, the main impetus came from Alex, as she revealed a dark secret which had been tormenting her for more than half of her life. According to Sandra, Alex, a seventh grader at the time, told her that Heredia, the father of her half-sisters, had been sexually abusing her since she was 7 years old. Shocked and horrified, Sandra threw Heredia out of her life, but he wasn't planning on going away easily. Reportedly, at first, Heredia was fine with the breakup, but continued popping up and trying to insinuate himself into their lives. It eventually got to the point where both Sandra and Alex were afraid of what he might do, as Sandra would claim that he had told her he didn't want to live without her. She later told the FBI that Heredia threatened to kill her if she didn't come back to him. Over the next few months, Heredia began fading from the picture, but he would return soon, and his attempts to not only be involved in Sandra's life, but to keep tabs on her and Alex would grow increasingly concerning. According to Sandra, on one particular day, she happened to catch Heredia standing on the roof of his car, trying to peek into the second floor windows of her home. On another, Alex confessed how frightened she was when she looked out her bedroom window and spotted Heredia standing on the roof of a building just across the alley, trying to see inside. At least once, Sandra returned home to find Heredia already in her house. When confronted, Heredia apparently claimed that when he'd come by, he found the front door open, but Sandra didn't believe him and insisted that he must have somehow copied the house keys. He denied this initially, but Sandra had the locks changed anyway. According to the Times News, Heredia had located a used condom in the home and confronted Anaya about it, accusing her of being with other men, which at the time, she was a single woman and free to do. But apparently, he did not see things that way. While he had denied that he was doing anything appropriate at the time, according to the Chicago Tribune, He later admitted to police that he had obtained an unauthorized copy of the house keys and stated that he had been following Sandra and Alex, as well as watching them inside of their home. During the summer of 2005, Alex and her family tried to move on with their lives and live them to the best of their abilities without Hedda Dia. Alex balanced social outings, which stretches a babysitting, volunteering at a local animal shelter, and spending large chunks of time with her sisters and mother. For the most part, the summer began easily enough, but by August, things would take a dark turn, and Hedda Dia would continue his campaign of stalking his ex and her older daughter. According to Sandra, Hedda Dia was keeping tabs on her and watching to see if any men were coming by the place. She claimed that his own sister warned her to be careful that he didn't learn about her dating and that he didn't see anyone else, but she wasn't about to let someone control her life or tell her who she could or couldn't see. Friday, August 12th, was just another normal day for Alex. In the early part, she spent time hanging out with friends before returning home to look after her sisters, who were now 6 years old. The family sat down to dinner, not knowing this would be the last family dinner they would have together. That evening, Sandra left Alex in charge while she went out on a date that she'd been looking forward to. Over the course of the next few hours, Sandra received several calls on her cell phone from Hedda Dia's number, but she didn't answer. It seems that when repeated calls to her cell weren't received, Hedda Dia then began calling the house looking for her. It's never been reported whether or not Hedda Dia managed to speak with either Alex or Sandra that night. Sandra returned home at approximately 3:30 a.m. on Saturday, August 13th, and was greeted by Alex, who was still awake. She explained that she'd put the twins to bed, and so mother and daughter took a seat and shared some White Castle sliders and fries. It was at this time Alex brought up the phone calls from Hedda Dia, and Sandra confirmed that he'd been calling her phone as well. According to Sandra, just after 4 a.m., she told Alex that she'd be stepping out for a short time and would return soon. Alex told Sandra that she was heading off to bed, and the two hugged and exchanged I love yous. This would be the last time Sandra would see her daughter alive. When she last saw her, Alex was wearing blue plaid pajama pants, a red Echo brand t-shirt, and a gold necklace she never took off, which had both a cross and a medallion of Jesus on it. Long shadows stretched over Pine Avenue as the morning sun steadily rose in the east. At approximately 6:45 a.m., Sandra arrived back at the house, slowly climbing the steps to the front door. Reaching into her purse, she retrieved her keys, but as she reached for the knob, she discovered that the door was unlocked. That was odd, she thought. Alex was always very good about ensuring the house was secured before she went to bed, and Sandra knew she'd locked the door behind her when she left. Once inside, it seemed everything was all right. The house was neat as she'd left it, and quiet with the children sound asleep. Making her way towards Alex's bedroom, Sandra opened the door, but found her daughter's bed empty. Assuming she had gone to sleep with her sisters, she turned and entered their room, but inside were only the twins. At that time, Sandra began searching around the house for any signs of her 13-year-old daughter, but she wasn't there. There was no note left, no indication of where she might have gone. Sandra, not yet panicked, assumed Alex might have taken a quick walk to a nearby corner store, as she did some mornings. It was when she reached the front door that she realized something was wrong. Sitting on the floor next to the door were Alex's shoes. Aside from Alex not being the type to just go out, leaving her sisters alone in the home without any kind of explanation, she definitely wouldn't be going anywhere without her shoes. Sandra walked outside and down the steps, heading for the corner store just across the street, but Alex wasn't there. Now her panic began growing, and she started walking around the area, calling out Alex's name, but the 13-year-old was nowhere to be found. After searching for her daughter for 15 to 20 minutes, Sandra quickly made her way back inside, picked up the phone, and called the police. The Hammond Police Department took a missing persons report over the phone, gathering basic information such as Alex's physical description, her known hangouts, anywhere she may have gone, and people that she was close with. According to Sandra, while police took the report, not much was done early on. She later told Case Files Chicago that the police essentially told her that they'd sent out her description, and if any officers came across the child, they'd pick her up. According to Hammond Police Chief Brian Miller, investigators made calls trying to track down Alex and also produced and distributed missing persons flyers. In hopes of locating Alex herself, Sandra enlisted the help of her family, who were scouring the area for the seventh grader. One of Alex's sisters later stated that even though she was six at the time, she can clearly recall her mother taking her and her sister out in the car for hours at a time while they drove around town looking for and calling out Alex's name. Sandra called every person she could think of, but none of them had seen her daughter. It didn't make any sense. How could she just have vanished into thin air? There was no sign of forced entry at the home, no indication that a struggle had taken place. It was almost as if Alex had opened the front door, walked outside, and disappeared. Initially, police felt Alex had likely gone off with a friend and would return home. They wanted to know if she and Sandra had had any arguments or anything that might have caused Alex to want to run away. But according to Sandra, the last time they'd spoken, everything was fine. When speaking to the Northwest Indiana Times, Sandra explained, quote, "I don't know what's got her upset. We haven't argued and we've been getting along okay. I've been trying to figure out what happened," end quote. According to the Hammond police, when they sent officers to canvass the neighborhood, they spoke with several witnesses who may have seen Alex the morning she vanished. There were several reports of a girl, fitting Alex's description, riding in the passenger seat of a red car, possibly a Toyota, that was being driven by a Caucasian male. When police brought this to Sandra, she didn't know who it could have been, as neither the car nor the man sounded familiar. Chief Miller later stated that they'd received several leads in the first days, but none of them had panned out. Lieutenant Ron Johnson was brought into the investigation and began working to get the story out to the media, along with photos and a description of Alex. While he hoped she was safe, he also knew that the more time passed, the more concerning her disappearance would become, and their best asset would be informing the public and hoping for a call with information, or at least some sightings. The first weekend passed with no developments. Alex hadn't been located, and outside of a few witnesses from that morning, no one believed they had seen the 13-year-old. The more time passed, the more desperate Sandra became, but she refused to give up hope. She believed her daughter was out there, and she was going to be found. On the morning of Monday, August 15th, Sandra went down to the local police station, hoping to speak with someone about her daughter to find out how the search was progressing, but they hadn't made much headway. Leads had dried up, and no new information had come in. But investigators tried to keep her calm and hopeful, explaining that she was a teenager and was likely holed up somewhere with a friend and would return soon. Sandra, though, knew that wasn't the type of person her daughter was. She'd have called or come home if she had the ability to. The very next day, Tuesday, August 16th, Lieutenant Johnson caught word of a body discovered in the Little Calumet River, just 8 miles to the west of the family's Pine Avenue home. At approximately 11:30 a.m., the Riverdale police received calls from a family who had discovered a body in the river, as well as calls from railroad employees working in the area who had spotted the remains and came down to the river to determine exactly what they had seen. After dispatching officers to the scene, the Riverdale police reached out to the Chicago police, asking for their assistance in making a water recovery. In response, the Chicago police sent down members of their Marine unit, who launched a boat into the river, at which time the Chicago police took over the case from Riverdale. Upon reaching the location of the remains, the Marine unit discovered that they were only partial. The remains were described as being those of a nude female torso, with the arms, legs, and head missing. The arms appear to have been severed where they met the body. The legs had been removed from just below the knee. The torso itself was weighted down, wrapped in heavy chains and straps, some of which were attached to a concrete block on the river bottom. At the time, police released few details, noting only that they had successfully retrieved the remains and pronounced the victim deceased at 2:24 p.m. An autopsy was scheduled to occur the following day with the Cook County Medical Examiner, and police were looking to run the victim's DNA through their system, since the mutilation would dramatically hinder their abilities to get a positive ID. On Wednesday, August 17th, the medical examiner's office conducted the autopsy, and while some new information was revealed, police were fairly strict about what they were willing to say. The cause of death was not released, but the medical examiner had unsurprisingly labeled it a homicide. The removal of the limbs was described as clean, and there's been speculation that the cuts may have been made with an electric saw, though police have never commented on what tool they believe was used. It was later stated that during the examination, they had also determined the victim had been sexually assaulted prior to being killed. Police Sergeant Robert Cargi, speaking to the Southtown Star, explained that they had received multiple calls from both other police departments and families of missing persons, asking if there were any tattoos or distinguishing marks, though at the time, no matches had been made. He also revealed that investigators had collected evidence at the scene, though he would not say what exactly, and that it was being processed. Despite their additional search efforts, police stated that they had not managed to locate the victim's missing head or limbs. One of the calls they'd received had come from Lieutenant Johnson, delivering the details of Alexandra's disappearance as well as a physical description. At the time, police didn't have much to work with, though they were able to tell Johnson that during the autopsy, it was discovered the victim's last meal had included French fries, as they were found only partially digested in her stomach. Being that they were still in her stomach and had not moved through her system, it was likely that the victim had been killed within 2 to 5 hours after eating that meal. It was at this time that Johnson placed a call to Sandra and asked to come to her house to discuss Alexandra's case. Hopeful that something had been learned, Sandra was taken aback and horrified when Johnson explained that a body had been found and he thought it would be a good idea for her to submit a DNA sample to the Chicago police. Sandra was torn by the possibility that her daughter could be dead, though she did visit the Chicago police where her cheek was swabbed, along with her sister's, to be compared to the victim. At the time, Sandra reportedly told authorities she was unsure why they wanted her DNA. She knew that couldn't possibly be Alex. The mere idea that her beloved daughter was dead was too much for her to accept, though her sister Martha, Alex's aunt, later told the Times she got a sinking feeling when she learned where the body had been found. Sandra described Alex to the detectives, noting that she had a scar on her chin and a sprained ankle, and that could help identify her without the DNA. She was, at the time, unaware that the limbs and head had been severed from the body and had not been located. Police told Sandra that the results of the test would take several weeks, and in the interim, she continued searching for Alex, believing she'd eventually be told that her DNA wasn't a match. Despite this, Chicago police wanted to discuss the case with her in order to gain any information they could about who may be responsible, if indeed it was Alex. When discussing the location in which the body had been found, Sandra had a startling revelation. The remains had been found in the river near 135th Street and Indiana Avenue. At the time, Rodolfo Heredia lived in a house at 324 East 138th Street, less than half a mile away. With his being the only name to come up thus far in the investigation, police began taking a closer look. 3 long and difficult weeks would pass, and with each day, Sandra had to struggle a little more with the possibility that Alex was gone. Then, in early September, Sandra was called down to speak with the Chicago police, who were joined by Lieutenant Johnson. At that time, investigators informed the mother that her DNA was a match, and they were able to positively identify the body pulled from the river as belonging to her 13-year-old daughter. Sandra absolutely collapsed, trying at first to deny it, but there was no changing this harsh reality. Lieutenant Johnson later described that moment to the Times, saying, quote, "She just fell apart, went down to her knees and crawled on the floor, crying and screaming, just lost it." End quote. Johnson tried to comfort Sandra and told her that she had to get up, wipe her tears, and do what needed to be done now to bring her daughter justice. Police once again discussed the case, and again Heredia's name came up. They conducted interviews with people who knew Heredia and began working to establish his potential connection to Alex's abduction and murder. Hoping for assistance with both the investigation and the processing of evidence, the Chicago police called in the FBI, who sent agents to help. It wouldn't take long for the focus on Heredia to sharpen, and on Wednesday, September 8th, nearly a month after Alex had been killed, investigators served a search warrant on his Riverdale home. While they would not give details to the press, Chicago police spokesman John Mirabelli stated that the search might be in regard to the discovery of Alex's remains, and he referred to the home as a, quote, possible crime scene, end quote. While the search was not concluded on Wednesday, Heredia was taken into custody that night. For Sandra, she was in shock in trying to accept the truth as much as she despised it. She didn't know what to do, where to go, who to turn to. There were decisions that needed to be made, but she could barely get herself out of bed each day. Family members began putting together funeral arrangements, but they weren't sure about finalizing them. According to the Times, they were hoping to wait until the rest of Alex's remains could be found. Martha later explained, quote, "We don't know what we're going to do. My sister wants to see her face and her long hair," end quote. The family also struggled with how to tell the twins what had happened, ultimately informing them that someone bad had hurt Alex and she wouldn't be coming home. For the 2 6-year-olds who absolutely idolized their older sister, they couldn't fully understand, but seeing how it impacted Sandra, they began to grasp the gravity of the situation. 2 days later, on Friday, September 10th, police spoke to the media for the first time regarding the arrest of Heredia. Being that Alex had been abducted from Indiana, though found in Chicago, this gave federal authorities jurisdiction. While the Chicago police told the Times that they were holding Heredia on charges of crossing state lines for the purpose of killing, injuring, harassing, or intimidating Alex as well as Sandra, federal prosecutors had different plans. According to their investigators, while interviewing Heredia, he admitted to following Alex and Sandra, looking into their windows and spying on their home, as well as having previously possessed an unauthorized key to the house. During their search of his home, police discovered that he had a new unauthorized key in his possession, which fit the lock Sandra had just gotten changed out, meaning he could still access the home. U.S. Attorney Joseph Van Bokkelen filed a charge for interstate domestic violence in U.S. District Court, and Heredia was scheduled to appear before Magistrate Paul Cherry. FBI Special Agent Wendy Osborne told reporters that officially, Heredia was being charged with federal stalking. While court documents revealed that the FBI alleged that Heredia had sexually assaulted Alex from the time that she was 7 years old, federal charges did not include abduction, sexual assault, murder, or dismemberment. Neither Chicago or Hammond police had filed charges related to those crimes either. FBI Special Agent Joel Stevens told reporters that Sandra described Heredia as a violent man with no regard for his actions, who had threatened her previously and who, she alleged, was obsessed with both her and Alex. Just a week later, on Saturday, September 17th, a memorial service was held for Alex at the Fife Funeral Home. Reverend Stephen Gibson presided over the memorial, where friends and family shared stories about the always smiling, loving, and sweet 13-year-old girl who had touched their lives and was taken too soon. While some stories managed to garner smiles and even a laugh or two, there were far more tears over such a vicious and violent end for a young woman who was so deeply loved and appreciated. In the end, Sandra made the choice to have Alex cremated. Less than a week after the service, on Thursday, September 22nd, Heredia was officially indicted and his arraignment was scheduled to take place the next month. On Tuesday, October 11th, 29-year-old Rodolfo Heredia pled not guilty to the stalking charge. The trial was scheduled to begin a month later on Monday, December 12th, for federal stalking and would take place at the Hammond Federal Courthouse. Heredia was represented by Arlington Foley, an attorney out of Merrillville. No charges were filed related to Alex's abduction and murder. Foley argued before Magistrate Cherry that his client was seeking to utilize his right to a speedy trial. A week prior to the trial, U.S. attorneys filed a superseding indictment against Heredia, charging him additionally with residential burglary, and the trial was moved, set to begin at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, January 4th, 2006. The trial was a difficult one for prosecutors, though they felt they had enough to prove the stalking charge. For Sandra, it was a nightmare, and she would be called to the stand to testify as the first witness for the government. She stated that she was in fear for her life in regard to Heredia and gave several examples of times he had behaved violently. In one instance, she alleged that he had struck a man with his vehicle after the man had insulted Sandra. In another, he allegedly struck a man, knocking him unconscious because he believed the man was flirting with Sandra. In terms of the breakup, she stated that she told Heredia they needed to take a break, and while he initially accepted this, he later told her he wouldn't let her be with anyone else. Foley, Heredia's attorney, argued that while the couple had a volatile relationship, Sandra had never reported his client to police for any violent incidents, nor did she report the alleged sexual assault. It should be noted, during the trial, no one, including Sandra, was allowed to mention that Alex had been murdered or that Heredia was being looked at as a possible suspect. Just 3 hours after closing arguments and only 2 days after opening arguments, on Friday, January 6th, the jury returned its verdict and Heredia was acquitted on all charges. Sandra was devastated, enraged, and terrified, and screamed at the jury that they didn't know who they were letting back onto the streets. The entire process had been painful and draining for the mother in mourning, who told the Times, quote, "They made me lie. They said, 'You have to say you have 3 daughters, like she's not dead.' I wasn't allowed to tell them he was a suspect in my daughter's death, the only suspect. I know why I was there and why I wanted him kept in jail. Now he's out and walking around free, and my daughter's not. I'm getting an order of protection right now. I don't want him coming anywhere near me." End quote. Several members of Heredia's family had been called to rebut Sandra's accusations of violent behavior during the trial. Heredia himself never took the stand. In the months following the acquittal, Sandra worked hard to try and return normalcy to her life and the lives of her twin daughters, whose biological father was Rudolfo Heredia. Nothing worked, however. Every day was a constant reminder of Alex, of what had happened to her, and of who Sandra believed was responsible. It was a nightmare. Her daughter was gone, but the man she believed killed her was free to do as he pleased. Sandra clung to hope that justice would eventually be served, but for investigators, while they continued working on Alex's case, they couldn't develop enough evidence to tie Heredia to the crime. That same year that he was acquitted, Lieutenant Johnson retired from the Hammond Police Department, but he never let go of Alex's case. As he later told reporters, not a day went by that he didn't think of Alex and what he could possibly do to find justice for her. Sadly, time continued moving, and soon, years began passing, each marked with a memorial posting in the local paper, acknowledging Alex's life and how she was stolen away from her family at just 13 years old. Sandra continued to raise her girls in Indiana, but eventually decided she had to get away, not just for their sake, but for her own. She loved Alex, and not a day went by that she wasn't thinking of her, but there were too many memories there, too many places to see and think about the times when Alex was still there, hanging with her friends, wondering what her daughter would have been like. There were also the dark thoughts, those which came creeping in and refused to be denied. What were her last moments like? Was she scared? Did she know what was going to happen? And of course, where was the rest of her, and would they ever find her? 2 years later, in late 2008, Sandra finally made the decision and picked up stakes. She and the girls left Indiana, moving 1,200 miles away to Texas. In March of 2009, she spoke with a reporter from the Northwest Indiana Times about her life in Texas, raising her children, and the status of Alex's case. Sandra explained, quote, "I still hold out hope that they'll find the rest of her and someone will pay for her murder. They took 13 years of my life in one night. I feel that my daughter doesn't rest in peace. Her hands are somewhere else. Her head is somewhere else." End quote. In regard to the Chicago police, Detective Sylvia Van Witsenberg explained that their suspect list still included, quote, "everyone." And while they'd received some tips over the years, none had ever delivered what they'd initially promised. It was, however, firmly an investigator's belief that there were others who had knowledge of the crime and were not coming forward. Another 8 years would pass with no new developments, no new discussions, not even new articles or stories about the case. 2015 marked 10 years since Alex was killed, and while her family has felt the horror every day without her, that terrible anniversary went unmentioned in the media. The following year, though, there would be a sudden flurry of stories written, news segments aired, and interviews conducted. The FBI held a press conference on Wednesday, August 31st, to announce the formation of their new Chicago Area Homicide Initiative Task Force, which would examine several unsolved homicides, including Alex's. At the conference, held at the FBI Chicago headquarters, Special Agent Courtney Corbett announced that they were planning to retest evidence from the case, though she noted no new leads had been developed. Speaking about the murder, which was referred to as one of the most heinous they had ever seen involving a child, Agent Corbett stated, quote, "Someone did this to Alexandra. Nobody deserves to go through what she went through. The person that did this is sitting at home, probably watching this. We believe this was not a random act of violence and that Alex knew her assailant. It has been more than a decade since Alex was murdered, and during that time, people and relationships have changed. We're hopeful that someone will come forward now. Maybe something heavy is on their heart, or they have information that they didn't think was significant at the time. This is not a cold case. We've never stopped working it." End quote. Images were shown of the necklace Alex always wore, and it was made clear her necklace had never been recovered, and they believe the killer might still be in possession of it, or possibly may have gifted it to someone. Special Agent Michael Anderson, who was in charge of Alex's case, also spoke, saying that they were seeking assistance from the public in solving the case. Anderson also referenced recent developments which had led them to examine new leads, though he would not specify what those developments were. Anderson stated that the killer had gone to great lengths to cover up the crime, but investigators believe there are witnesses with information pertinent to the investigation, and he urged them to come forward. Lieutenant Johnson, retired at this point for 10 years, attended the press conference saying he maintains his files on the case and is haunted by it, telling reporters, quote, "The thing that sticks with you about this case is the gruesome way she was murdered and the way she was found. There were many sleepless nights, and it haunts you." End quote. When asked whether or not Rodolfo Heredia was still considered a suspect, Special Agent Corbett would not comment, noting that it's an open and ongoing investigation. Corbett concluded the conference by updating their work on the case, explaining, quote, "We have been reviewing leads and re-interviewing individuals associated with this case. The DNA evidence has been well preserved, and we plan to use enhanced technology to exploit that evidence. We want to bring justice to Alex and other victims like her and their families. To do that, and to ultimately reduce the homicide rate in Chicago, we all have to work together." End quote. When reached for comment by the Chicago Tribune, Sandra said she was glad to see things were moving and Alex hadn't been forgotten. She explained, quote, "I'm hoping for an arrest. That's what I'm wishing for. It makes me feel happy, excited, and sad at the same time." End quote. Two more years would pass, and in August of 2018, the FBI announced they were offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in Alex's case. Special Agent Jeffrey Sallet made a statement after the announcement, saying, quote, "We are confident there is someone out there who knows what happened to Alex. It is 13 years later, and her horrific demise remains unsolved. We hope that in the time that has passed that someone will find the courage to come forward now. With the help of the public, we truly feel we will bring Alex's murderer to justice." End quote. In 2019, Sandra sat down for an interview with the Chicago Tribune to discuss her daughter, the murder, and the 14 years that had passed. She had moved to Texas with her daughters, and in 2011 had another child, a son she noted would never meet his older sister. While in Texas, Sandra tried to move forward but found that a change of scenery hadn't altered reality. She sought assistance in therapy and found a way to live on, though she stated that she sometimes feels guilty for trying to live her life with Alex gone and her killer free to walk the streets. She eventually returned to Indiana to be near family and to hope the ghosts of her grief had settled somewhat in her absence. Still, when she needs a moment to herself, when she needs time to cry, scream, or just speak to her daughter, she always finds herself at the same place, on the banks of the Little Calumet River. She visits the location every February 10th, Alex's birthday. Her bedroom is covered in photographs of Alex, and her daughter's ashes are kept there as well. For every birthday that passes, she adds a balloon and a stuffed animal to her dresser while struggling to accept the reality. In February of 2019, another of Alex's birthdays came and went. For Sandra, it's difficult to believe her daughter is a perpetual teenager, telling the Tribune, quote, "She would have been 27, but she's not. She's still 13. She was here. She was my daughter. I had her for 13 years, and she's gone now," end quote. Alexandra Maria Anaya was last seen in the early morning hours of Saturday, August 13, 2005, at the family home on Pine Avenue in Hammond, Indiana. When last seen, Alex was described as being a 13-year-old Hispanic female with brown eyes and long brown hair, standing 5 feet 1 inch tall and weighing approximately 125 pounds. At the time of her abduction, Alex had a sprained ankle. She was last seen wearing navy blue plaid pajama pants, a red Echo t-shirt, and a gold necklace with a Jesus medallion and cross. Alex had a scar on her chin. 3 days later, on Tuesday, August 16th, Alex's partial remains were discovered in the Little Calumet River, just across the line outside of Riverdale. It's believed she was killed within hours of her disappearance. Her cause of death, if known, has never been revealed. To this day, her necklace, her clothing, her arms, legs, and head have never been recovered. 15 years have passed, and this summer will mark the 16th. Alexandra Anaya has been gone now for longer than she was alive, and yet she continues to touch those who examine her case, and of course, those who were lucky enough to have been near her and to have loved her. For all these years, a brutal, vicious, and violent killer has eluded investigators, not just stealing Alex from her family, but robbing them of justice, robbing them of any form of closure they might ever feel. When asked about closure, Sandra explained she would only feel closure when she knew what her daughter's last words were. Sandra worries that someday her daughter will be forgotten, that her case will fall to the side and remain unsolved. Where others can move on, forget, ignore, Sandra and her family must live with the pain, the unknowing, the anger, and the grief. Perhaps, if nothing else, Alex can be kept alive by never allowing her name to get lost to time. As Sandra so mournfully put it, quote, "People saw it on the news, and then they changed the channel, and they forgot about it because it wasn't their family member. Please, don't forget this happened to this little girl." Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that keeps you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trace. I honestly don't even know where to begin. I've covered some truly horrifying cases in the past, and yes, in some of those cases, the victims were teenagers or young children, but the murder of Alexandra Anaya exceeds even my nightmares. A smart, kind, loving, talented, athletic teenager vanishes from her home, and while her family believes she's gone off somewhere, or perhaps been abducted, they could never imagine how terrible the truth would be. I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like for Sandra to sit down in the police station and learn that her beloved daughter at just 13 has been murdered. Not just murdered, but sexually assaulted as well. How helpless, how lost, heartbroken, and completely devastated she must have felt in that moment. And then to learn that she was dismembered, wrapped in chains and left in a river where she remained for at least 2 days. While Sandra and her family were out searching for Alex, she was beneath the water. When Sandra dialed 911 the moment she realized her child was missing, there's a good chance she'd already been killed. Her daughter's gone, and she has no forehead to kiss, no hair to brush back from her face, no hand to hold when she said goodbye. The killer first robbed Alex of her innocence and then her life. He stole the loving teen from her mother, from her sisters, from a family and friends who thought the world of her, who never imagined there'd come a day where her smile wasn't there to comfort them. He took away that smile, those brown eyes, that long mane of hair. He raped, murdered, dismembered, and tried to conceal the body of a 13-year-old girl whose life hadn't even begun yet. He didn't just take her past, he took her future. And with it, he forever altered the lives of her family, who will never know what she may have done with her life or how her choices may have shaped their own lives. They're left instead with questions, with nightmares, with memories whose recall is often invaded by the knowledge of how it ended for Alex. All the while, that monster is still out there walking the streets, living his life, and who knows what family he might destroy next. This is why it's so important to see justice done. Not just to give closure to Alex's family, because honestly, no matter what, they're never going to have that. Not just to see Alex's murder avenged and punished, because no punishment could possibly be enough. But to ensure no family ever has to suffer with such a tremendous and painful loss at the sadistic whim of a vile, cowardly, unconscionable piece of shit. Now, I'd like to be able to tell you there's a lot of leads here, that there's a lot of evidence and information to sort through that might at some point lead to the confirmed identity, arrest, and imprisonment of Alex's killer, but the fact of the matter is, I find it hard to keep faith with that possibility. Not because it can't happen, but because it hasn't happened, and the likelihood that there are people out there who know his name, who know what he did, and can somehow sleep at night without calling it in, without leaving an anonymous tip. In my book, that makes them just as monstrous, if not more so. If you have the ability to stop someone who raped, murdered, and butchered a 13-year-old girl, and you elect not to, then her blood is just as much on your hands, and any terrible twist of fate you may encounter is more than fucking deserved. So let's move into the theories here, because in all honesty, if I don't turn my focus away from these spineless child-murdering condoners, I'm just gonna fucking lose it. As you might imagine, there aren't many theories that have been presented. Investigators fully believe that whoever was responsible for this atrocious act knew Alex and knew her family. There's never been much of a consideration given to the possibility that there was anything random about the crime. Alex was specifically targeted. So that gives us essentially two theories. Either Alex was abducted and murdered by the only person who has ever faced any charges in relation to this case, Rodolfo Heredia, or the killer was someone else from her life who, over all these years, has managed to evade detection. I think it makes the most sense to address these theories simultaneously, to go through what we know, to filter it through Heredia, and then to try and apply it to the possibility of someone else, so let's try that and be a little different today. I want to preface this by saying almost everything we have learned about Heredia comes from Sandra. He's never given a public interview, and outside of public records, court documents, and arrest records, we don't know a great deal about his everyday life. So we can really only focus on the time he was around Sandra and her family. Because nothing related to the accusations Sandra made was ever reported to authorities, there were never any official reports taken, arrests made, or judgments rendered, and I therefore must refer to them as alleged incidents or purported crimes. According to Sandra, she and Heredia met in a Chicago-area neighborhood approximately 10 years prior to Alex's murder, so somewhere around 1995, which would mean that he came into their lives when Alex was around 3 years old. Sandra went on to explain that over time, Heredia was violent, threatening, and intimidating to the point where she was afraid to leave him. The final straw came when Alex allegedly told her mother that Heredia had been molesting her from the time that she was 7 years old, which would have been in 1999. This would mean that for 5 to 6 years, Alex was subjected to this abuse and held that dark secret to herself. For a child who was killed at age 13, she surely experienced far more pain and abuse than many people do in their entire lives. Bizarrely, this coincides somewhat with the birth of the twins, who are Heredia's biological children. They were born around 1998, and this would mean the alleged assaults began not long after the kids came along. There have been a plethora of studies conducted regarding child sexual abuse as perpetrated by biological parents, as well as step-parents and significant others who live in the same house as their partner and children. While the statistical conclusions vary to some degree, most studies conclude that the likelihood of a female child experiencing sexual abuse was dramatically larger with a stepfather or mother's boyfriend, while biological fathers are more likely to physically abuse the child and less likely to sexually abuse them. Obviously, there are factors which can influence the likelihood of sexual abuse occurring, including but not limited to the psychological disposition of the abuser, the home dynamic, the abuse of drugs and alcohol, etc. I should also note that while studies show females are much more likely to experience sexual abuse in the home, the number of male children who have been subjected to sexual abuse has been steadily rising over the decades. Outside of the alleged sexual abuse Alex was subjected to, Sandra gave several examples of times where she claimed that Heredia had become violent and made threats. She testified that he hit someone with a car, struck another man and knocked him unconscious, and threatened to kill her if she left him. I've seen in some forums online derogatory statements about Sandra because she failed to protect Alex, or she didn't get away from Heredia soon enough, or she should have been filing reports with the police or whatever. I think it's important to keep in mind that she was subjected to abuse as well, and that plays a major role in what decisions and choices she made. Victims of domestic violence and intimate partner abuse can be subjected to a number of different forms of abuse, including but not limited to physical, emotional, verbal, sexual, and stalking. Heredia, according to investigators, admitted to following Sandra and Alex, peering into their windows, keeping tabs on them, and duplicating a key to their home in order to gain access after Sandra had told him never to come back. I can't begin to imagine what it was like for them, having to constantly look over their shoulders, worrying about when he would pop up again and what he might do. The psychological impact of having to live that way, following an extended period of direct abuse and threats, is extremely damaging to the psyche. According to arrest records in Illinois, as well as Indiana and other states, Heredia established quite a rap sheet prior to Alex's murder and has continued to build upon that history in the years since. That history includes arrests for battery as well as charges related to drugs. However, there are no established history of charges related to serious infliction of bodily harm, no attempted murder, no direct assault. That either means that no one ever filed charges in those situations, or he was never directly identified, or he was never actually in a situation where his behavior crossed that line. In all reality, unless something occurs in the future, we don't have much of a way of knowing what Heredia, or anyone else for that matter, is truly capable of. Looking specifically through the lens of Alex's abduction and murder, there's a few pieces of information which seem pertinent. We've already established a history of what could be defined as stalking, though in court, Heredia was acquitted when charged with that crime. On the night Alex was abducted, Heredia placed at least 5 calls to Sandra's cell phone as well as the home. No specific times for those calls has ever been given by investigators, though I'd be very interested to know how much time there was between the final call and the window during which Alex was taken. This may suggest that he was exceptionally angry or focused on Alex and Sandra that night. We know Sandra had gone out on a date, and according to her testimony, Heredia had warned her that he would not allow her to be with someone else. Many have theorized that if he somehow was aware that Sandra was going out with someone that night, he may have felt the urge to seek revenge or lash out, but that's all speculative. We know from evidence taken from Heredia's home when police executed their search warrant that he was in possession of a key to the new lock Sandra had installed, and we also know that there were no signs of forced entry the night Alex was taken. Being that there was no sign of a struggle, this suggests a handful of possibilities. Alex being taken from her bed, possibly being subdued or restrained in some way, being threatened with a weapon or some other form of intimidation to keep her quiet, or maybe the 13-year-old was lured outside by some other method. Given his history of keeping tabs on the family and the calls that he made that night, it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility that he could have become aware Sandra was out by watching the house. According to investigators, Alex was abducted sometime between the hours of 4:30 and 6:45. Heredia lived at East 138th Street in Riverdale at the time, just 8 miles or a 17-minute drive from the house on Pine Avenue. Total round-trip travel time could have been as little as 34 minutes. That leaves a lot of additional time before Alex is even discovered to be missing, assuming she was abducted closer to 4:30 than 6:45. The location of Alex's body in the Little Calumet River was less than a mile from 138th Street, just across the line outside of Riverdale. Accounting for the time to drive there and back, you're looking at approximately 10 minutes round trip, which increases the travel time from 34 to 44 minutes. Injuries to Alex's body discovered during the autopsy suggested that she had been sexually assaulted that night, likely prior to her murder. I really don't wish to try and determine how long that may have gone on. So let's just say between getting her out of the car, into wherever this took place, committing the act and then committing the murder and dismembering her body, this could have taken anywhere between 1 and 3 hours. We also know, based on the undigested fries in her stomach, that she had been alive for 2 to 5 hours after eating that night. Assuming the meal was eaten in that window of time between 3:30 and 4:30, this would place her time of death as being anywhere between 5:30 and 9:30 a.m. So on the short end, we're looking at approximately 3.5 to 5.5 hours. If Alex was taken at, say, 5 a.m., she may have been in the river as early as 8:30. How long she was actually in the river was never precisely determined. It could have been as little as 24 hours, or as much as 72. This leaves open the possibility that while the murder could have occurred the night she was taken, the dismemberment and disposal could have been delayed to the next night, as the sun rose at 5:57 a.m. on Saturday, August 13th, and it seems unlikely that anyone would be attempting to make this kind of a dump in daylight hours. So yes, you can make the time frame work for Heredia. The problem is, that time frame could also work for almost anyone living within the surrounding 20 or 30 miles, or even someone in Hammond itself. So we know Heredia lived in Riverdale, approximately a 20-minute drive to the Pine Avenue apartment. We also know he lived within 0.5 mile of where Alex was found. Beyond that, in and around 2005, Heredia had multiple family members and associates who lived in a tight cluster within 5 miles of that stretch of the river. He had a history with Alex and Sandra, had been accused of being violent, threatening, and of sexually assaulting Alex over the course of 5 to 6 years. He admitted to police that he was following his ex and her daughter, keeping tabs on them and peering in their windows. He got copies of keys to the house and then was able to get copies for the new locks. While all of this is extremely compelling, investigators have never been able to directly link Heredia to the abduction or the murder. A lot of people tend to believe if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, then it's a duck. And while it's fine to make that leap if you choose, it simply doesn't work when it comes to the law. There was a lot of outrage that Heredia was not charged with Alex's murder when he was arrested, But that was a smart move by the prosecutors. They didn't have enough evidence to convict, and if he'd been acquitted, they'd be staring down the barrel of double jeopardy, should they ever find the evidence they actually need. Again, circumstantially, it really draws your attention, but you also have to look at what evidence can't be found. Police executed a search warrant on Heredia's home the day he was arrested. They referred to his home as a possible crime scene. However, they never found solid evidence to put Heredia at Alex's home that night. There was no evidence putting her in his vehicle, none putting her inside of his home. Knowing how Alex was mutilated, it's hard to believe that if that took place at his house, there wouldn't have been some evidence found. I can't imagine how much blood would have been spilled, and cleaning all of that up in a way where nothing would be missed, no trace left behind, that would be a monumental task. No one location has ever been named as a possible crime scene beyond that, but that doesn't mean it couldn't have happened almost anywhere else. One interesting detail to note is the presence of marinas and fishing locations in the area, some of which are equipped with fish cleaning stations that often have high-powered grinders strong enough to completely shred fish parts, big and small, as well as cans, plates, utensils, lures, and various other solid objects. Many of these would also have a high-powered sink with a waste disposal system. Unfortunately, the truth is, the crime could have been committed at any number of locations, but again, nothing has ever been found to confirm one place as being the spot where Alex was murdered and dismembered. We do know they possessed certain pieces of evidence, in fact, pieces which have been retested, but we don't know what that evidence is. We've also heard them mention DNA evidence being preserved. Yet, 16 years later, no arrests, no charges, no public naming of a suspect. We know Alex was sexually assaulted before she was murdered. Considering Sandra's allegation against Heredia, there would be a history there if you could prove it. I suppose the major hang-up, at least for me, when it comes to the Heredia theory, is what happens after. Working in true crime, or even just being someone who watches and listens to a lot of true crime shows, dismemberment comes up a lot, but in reality, it's rather rare. It's also considered an extremely grueling process, not just physically, but mentally. Even some of the most brutal and intense serial killers the world has ever known would shy away from dismembering a body, especially the body of a child. Many studies have been done about almost all aspects of mutilation as carried out by a killer. There are generally four categories, the first of which is known as defensive mutilation. This is described as when a victim is dismembered in order to conceal evidence, make it easier to dispose of the body, or to make it harder for authorities to identify the victim. In many cases, it's believed, the type of dismemberment which occurred here signifies that the killer is attempting to destroy the link between himself and the victim, because if she can't be identified, then police can't determine a relationship between the two. Then, there's aggressive mutilation, which is thought to come out of the same rage that leads to the murder itself and is done, or in some cases, is the cause of death. The next type is very similar to aggressive, though it brings in a sexual sadistic aspect in which the killer achieves sexual gratification by inflicting pain and serious injury to the victim. Then there is necromantic mutilation, in which the killer dismembers the body post-mortem, but with the purpose of using some body parts as either symbols, trophies, or to feed a fetish. There can also be instances in which different types overlap. A Boston University study entitled Dismemberment and Mutilation of Victims Postmortem, A Guide for the Medical Legal Death Investigator, looked at a lot of different scenarios, broke them down into categories, and addressed both the physical and psychological profiling aspects of the investigation itself. This study offers various flowcharts which can be followed based on specific evidentiary criteria. Decapitation and the removal of hands, with the parts being hidden, is correlated to the killer being a close family member or friend of the victim. Complete dismemberment, severed limbs hidden, also is correlated to being a family member or someone close to the victim. Both are classified under defensive mutilation. So the question in this case would have to be, what was the motive for the dismemberment? Could it have had to do with the sexual assault and some kind of sadistic sexual gratification, or is it more likely this heinous act was conducted in order to conceal Alex's identity, completely halt, or at best, delay the identification process in order to hide any potential links between Alex and her killer? The FBI's been quite clear. They 100% believe that Alex knew her killer. We can extrapolate that the killer likely believes he would be looked at as a suspect, and so trying to hide her identity would also help protect him from being looked into. While in many serial situations, limbs or body parts can be taken as trophies to be kept by the killer to relive the crime, that doesn't appear to be the case here. This wasn't a serial situation. This wasn't a signature of a killer who committed similar crimes. This seems to have been a lone situation where the dismemberment was likely done secondary to the murder, perhaps premeditated, or as a result of panic from the killer after the homicide occurred. But here's the problem. If the sole goal is to create distance, to throw off suspicion, to ensure investigators never find the killer because they can't identify the victim, why would someone put the body less than half a mile from their own home? We've seen killers in the past who use their own land or home as a location to store or dump bodies, while others select public lands, often vacant and remote and far from their own homes, creating distance between themselves and the bodies under some belief that this will create distance between investigators and the killer. In this case, and specifically through the lens of considering Heredia, it's somewhat confusing. If he was responsible, it seems contradictory to go to the lengths of dismemberment only to leave Alex close to your house. Lake Michigan was just over 10 miles to the northeast. Why select a river with many different shallow areas half a mile from your house when you could drive another 10 minutes and have the vast depths of Lake Michigan to work with? Panic, poor planning, a desire to keep her close, inexperience, take your pick. It seems quite clear from the location, plus the use of chains, straps, and a cement block, that the killer didn't really understand how all of this works. It seems almost like someone who had never done this before and thought, well, in movies, this is what they do. It could also have been time sensitive. Sandra's going to find her daughter missing. She's going to call police. And if you've got a volatile history with her and Alex, she's going to say your name. You have to get rid of all evidence and Alex as fast as possible, because when the police come knocking on your door, you don't want to have to worry about them looking in the trunk or in your garden. To me, this would suggest the crime was more spur of the moment than premeditated. Certain parts may have been pre-planned, maybe fantasized about, but the exact time and day chosen may have come as the result of any number of factors, and once things were in motion, it all began to fall apart. Nothing ever goes the way you imagine it will. Nothing is ever easy like you assume it will be. But I digress. Frankly, it's simply not possible to go through all the different options without knowing more about the crime. We don't know how Alex was dismembered, what tools may have been used, but investigators likely have an idea based on how the cuts were and tool marks left behind. All we really know is they describe the cuts as being clean, which to me suggests not necessarily an anatomical or medical skill, but perhaps a tool powerful enough to make the cuts in one foul swoop. Perhaps a power saw or piece of industrial-grade equipment, for instance. Again, we come to this contradictory point, though. A seemingly poorly planned disposal site based on flawed knowledge of chaining down a body juxtaposed against the knowledge and ability to choose the right tool and location, whereby no physical evidence is discovered and the cuts themselves are noted as being cleaned by a medical professional. It almost makes you think about the possibility that you could be looking at more than one person here. Maybe one who perpetrates the crime and another who assists in the aftermath. Or another factor which is unknown, like the influence of drugs or alcohol, a psychological disorder, etc. I suppose at the end of the day, after you look at everything you possibly can and examine every angle you can conceive of, it almost always comes down to the most basic questions. Motive, means, opportunity. In terms of a motive, you've got several possibilities there. Anger, jealousy, rage, wanting to inflict pain both to Alex and her mother as some sort of revenge. Possibly things getting out of control. Maybe the original plan was to sexually assault Alex, but the killer murders her in the process and then has to come up with a plan quickly. I think we also have to consider the copied key to that house as well. There's nothing saying that someone else couldn't have been given a copy, leading to a crime committed by a third party, either for money or some other reason. We know that prior to the trial, prosecutors introduced another charge, that being burglary. It's never stated, at least not in any place I can find, what exactly it was believed was taken. Could a copy of that key have been given out with a plan for a burglary that suddenly transformed into something vastly more messed up? Alex wakes up, hears a noise, sees the person, and is taken, or this person sees Alex sleeping in her bed and decides to take her. You could speculate endlessly, I imagine. Hell, you could even be looking at someone who knew Alex, someone that she may have actually trusted because, let's face it, she's not willingly going anywhere with Heredia. And that person could have lured her outside, knocked on the door, done any number of things to get her out of that house. Several witnesses thought they saw Alex in a red car with a Caucasian male. Sandra didn't know who that could have been, nor did seemingly anyone else in Alex's life. Sure, the witnesses could be mistaken, or we could be looking for someone who hasn't been examined yet. If that was the case, then maybe placing Alex so close to Heredia was purposeful to throw suspicion onto him. Again, what's the first name Sandra's going to say when she calls 911 and they ask, "Is there anyone your daughter was afraid of? Anyone who may have wanted to harm her or harm you through her?" You always have to keep in mind things are not always as they appear, and sometimes when absolutely everything seems to point in one direction, you may also want to look the opposite way to see if someone's trying to direct you away from the difficult truth and towards a more convenient, seemingly obvious solution. Just because someone is described as being a terrible person doesn't necessarily mean they're also a sadistic, brutal, and vicious killer. The truth is, despite what we do know about this case, there is far more that we do not know. This feels like a case where while we have a lot of information about the crime, the timeline, and how things may have occurred, we know very little about the surrounding circumstances. Heredia has been so much of a lightning rod for this case, and given the information we have, it's understandable to a degree, but are there other possibilities? Yeah. Could someone in Alex's life have been jealous, angry, disturbed, vengeful, and vicious? Was there anyone besides Heredia who Alex didn't feel comfortable around or felt threatened by? Was there someone who may have had a grudge against Sandra, Alex, or both, who was close enough to know Heredia would be a person to point the finger at? I just can't help but feel like I'm missing something from the puzzle and the picture is a bit hazy. Look, I don't know the guy. I only know what Sandra told investigators, which is diametrically opposed to what his friends and family told them. That's to be expected. But the truth is, we have no way of knowing anything here for certain. It's extremely easy to look at the long arrest record, an admission of following and creeping on Alex and Sandra, the location Alex was found in, the calls that were made that night that she was murdered, and say, yeah, this totally makes sense. The gap for me comes in the crime itself. There's a massive difference between the known and alleged acts and murdering and dismembering a 13-year-old girl, especially one that's been around in your life since she was a toddler. Unfortunately, we also know some people are capable of horrendous acts, and they're often committed by those no one saw it coming from. So could Heredia have done this either alone or with assistance? Yes. But can you say, beyond a reasonable doubt, with the existing evidence and testimony, that not only could he have done this, but he was the only one that could have done this, the only one with a reason to do this, and the type of person to have done this, ruling out all other possibilities? Given what we have right now, no. Not legally, at least. That's why there were no charges related to Alex's abduction and murder. They never would have gotten a conviction without something more, and for now, they don't have what they need. As frustrating as it may be, that's the reality of this crime. I know a lot of you are going to be angry. You're going to feel like it's so clear what happened here, and I understand that sentiment, but I also remember the case of Isabel Celis and how everything seemed to point towards her father. For years, podcast after podcast, show after show, including this one, came out balking at how it could only have happened one way, and in the end, he was innocent. I'm not here to decide who is guilty and who is innocent. I'm just here to weigh the options and consider what could have occurred. Rodolfo Heredia could surely have committed this crime, but it's also undeniable that, as of this moment, based on the facts and evidence available, someone else could have as well. I have my personal opinion. I have what makes the most sense to me. And if you want to ask me off the record, I'll give it to you. But could I morally, legally, or openly say that I know what happened here and it's super obvious? No. The evidence we do have points one way, but it's the evidence we don't have that creates the rift. And for now, there's not enough to officially charge anyone. Hell, there's not even enough for Heredia to be named as an official suspect. In the 16 years since, he's never even been called a person of interest. That doesn't imply innocence, not by a long stretch, but it does leave the door open to different possibilities. We've also heard the FBI mention following new leads. So what do you think? If you were sitting on a jury and the currently known evidence was delivered, could you in good conscience vote guilty? Or would you feel that without more evidence, something to directly tie the defendant to the crime, that there was still too much reasonable doubt to convict? I'd really love to know your answers on that. This is an extremely difficult case, just from the outside perspective of someone who has only learned about it secondhand through news articles, interviews, and court documents. I can't begin to fathom what this has been like for Alex's family and friends. Such a horrible ending to what was just the beginning of a teenager's life. Alexandra deserves justice. Her family deserves to see her killer arrested, charged, and convicted of this incredibly monstrous crime. Nothing can change it. Nothing can bring Alex back. Nothing can ever assuage the grief, pain, and loss of a sister, daughter, grandchild, cousin, and friend. The least that can be done is to honor Alex by never forgetting and seeing justice served in her name. There's a quote from Voltaire that's always rung true to me and was, in a way, the foundation of this podcast. To the living, we owe respect, but to the dead, we owe only truth. Alexandra deserves both and much more. Sadly, as the case is today, things seem to be at a standstill. There's evidence. It's been tested and retested. Each day, technology develops more, and someday there may be technology available that can finally unlock the truth that evidence carries. The FBI, Chicago Police, and Hammond Police all agree. Someone out there knows what happened. Someone out there has the ability to honor Alex and bring some sense of closure or relief by standing up and speaking the truth. The fact of the matter is, if you know who killed Alex, if you know what was done to this child, if you've seen the pain in her family and you haven't spoken up, you are as much a monster as the killer. I don't know if you're listening, but I'd like to take a moment to just speak directly to anyone who might have information about this case and isn't sharing it. I'm sure there's someone out there that you love, someone who means the world to you, maybe a child, a friend, a parent. Now, imagine that person being taken in the middle of the night, dragged to some isolated location where that person is raped, murdered, and butchered. Imagine the fear, the pain, and the horror. Imagine knowing you're never going to see them again and being helpless to do anything about it. Imagine someone desecrating their body, both leading up to the murder and after. Having a funeral, but not being able to see their face, hold their hand, or even give them an open casket. Knowing that they are not whole and that, even after they're gone, the killer's still out there and may even possess the missing pieces like some sick trophy or sadistic prize. Can you imagine standing at the muddy banks of a river on holidays, birthdays, and anniversaries, staring down into the water knowing this is where they were found, this is where the person you love was left, and as horrible as it is, it's one of the only places in which you feel like you could still be close to them? Now imagine someone knew the killer, knew the truth, and couldn't even be bothered to send in an anonymous tip. What kind of person can possess this knowledge and live with it, knowing that each day they're protecting the type of person who would do this? We've all lost people we've loved. We've all felt that pain. We've gone through the grieving process, felt the onset of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and eventually, cold acceptance. Your life is never the same, but in most cases, you're lucky enough to know why. Whether it's an illness, an accident, something that's been coming, or something sudden and unexpected, it doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't take the pain away, but it does allow you to come to terms with it. Now imagine never being able to come to terms with it, never being able to accept it, Because every day you wake up and every night you go to bed, you're wondering why this happened and who could have done it. In every stranger's face, you're seeing a suspect, and when you try to retreat into your memories to recall the good times you had together, the awful details begin creeping in, infecting everything, and eventually you can't remember a smile without also remembering your loved one dismembered and dumped by a nameless, faceless, cowardly animal. What would you give to see him pay? To see him have to face the consequences of his own wrath? A crime like this doesn't just take Alex away. It destroys families, causes such an emotional trauma that many people never fully recover. This killer didn't just murder Alex. He tortured her family. He stole the light from their lives, and while they may go on, it'll never be the same. Alexandra Anaya was just 13 years old when she was sexually assaulted, murdered, dismembered, and dumped in the Little Calumet River in August of 2005. She's been gone now longer than she was alive, and if she was here today, she'd be 29 years old. Losing a 29-year-old is still a terrible tragedy to see someone go so young. Having someone stolen from you at 13, I have to say, I give Sandra a lot of credit because I don't think I could do what she has done. To live, to provide for her other children, to try and give them the best life she can. I honestly don't think I'd make it through something like that. Alex's case has never been labeled as cold. It's been actively pursued by one of three different law enforcement organizations, and to this day, there are investigators trying to put the pieces together. All they need is a message, a call, an anonymous tip to break the case open and put a soulless killer behind bars for the rest of his life. Pick up the phone, send an email, leave a tip. It's not too late to set your wrong choices right. However, if you still believe it's worth keeping the secret and protecting this person, then you should forever forfeit your right to complain when bad things happen, to ask why me when terrible situations unfold, because you'll deserve everything you receive. Lying on your deathbed years from now, how do you want to look back on your life? Knowing that you saved a child rapist and murderer from prison? Or believing that even in a life full of mistakes and bad choices, you got this one thing right? Because without the discovery of new evidence, advanced technologies cracking the secrets of current evidence, or someone having the courage to step forward and share what they know, the murder of Alexandra Anaya will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the abduction and murder of Alexandra Anaya, there are many news articles available online. There are also several YouTube videos, some of which have been made by amateurs, other by news stations, and one in particular called Case File Chicago, which did about 22 minutes about the case and includes interviews with Alexandra's family and investigators. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Alexandra Anaya, please contact the FBI Chicago Field Office at 312-421-6700. You can also leave an anonymous tip by going to fbi.gov/tips. You can text anonymous tips to the Chicago Police Department by sending the word CPD followed by your tip to the number 274637. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Tragically and heartbreakingly, there are a lot of children, adults, friends, family members who are subjected to abuse of all forms in the home and outside of it. If you or someone you love is being subjected to intimate partner violence or domestic violence, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. You can also call Child Help by dialing 1-800-4-A-CHILD. That's 1-800-422-4453. If you are aware of a child who is experiencing sexual abuse or suspicious that a child might be being sexually abused, you can call RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network at 1-800-656-HOPE. That's 1-800-656-4673. You can also contact Darkness to Light at 1-866-4-LIGHT. That's 1-866-367-5444. Horrifyingly, there are many forms of abuse which can occur at home, at school, social gatherings, friends' houses, and everywhere in between. Parents, talk to your children about this before somebody else does. Let them know what is and is not appropriate behavior. Let them know they can ask you anything they need to and that they can come to you with any problem they might have. And remember, it's not just children who can be victims of this kind of abuse. And for adults, there are also options. Hotlines, websites, places that can help you through that difficult and dark time. Obviously, you always have the option of calling your local police as well. Abuse of all kinds is an epidemic that needs to be stopped. Trace evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Vox Nihili. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening, sharing the show, and helping keep these cases alive. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.